are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
What have we been doing wrong in the experience of music in schools that has relegated it to something that's so unimportant?
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance and research-based publications.
2018 marked the centenary of some woman winning the right to vote in the UK. At Teacher Toolkit, we commemorate the anniversary by interviewing 100 women working in the field of education or in the public eye in order to catalogue their lives, celebrate their successes, and find out what challenges they face and discover what they would like to pass on to the next generation.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Nicola Benedetti, a classical violinist and recent recipient of a CBE for her services to music. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are the Suzuki teaching method and how it benefits young musicians, healthy perspectives to view making mistakes through, and the case for music being back on the EBAC curriculum.
I am with Nicky Benedetti. Nicky, can you just introduce yourself to listeners and tell us what you do?
So I'm a violinist and a musician, I guess. That's what I do. That's what I've always done.
Now, being quite humble here, you got your own Wikipedia page. You're a dame. I'm very humble and a great presence here. But could you just elaborate on? I don't know if you have a typical working week, but could you kind of describe what you do week to week?
Well, yes and no, and there is no typical working week. That's the only thing that's sure about my life, is that this week will not look anything like last week or next week. So throughout the year, I travel all the time, and the nature of being a solo violinist performer means that you are employed by any given orchestra from anywhere in the world. So I have a management and a kind of a team of people that help me to schedule all the various different things that I do and that I get invited to do. But fundamentally, what I've been doing for the majority of my life since I was 16 years old is performing all over the world.
Could you describe your life at school, your influences?
So I went to a school in Scotland. I went to Wellington School, which was a girls' school. It's a private school. I went there till I was 9 years old. My relationship to the violin was through a method called Suzuki method, which is hugely successful all over the world and has an enormous following, and you can understand why. It's a method that actually encourages, rather than going purely through a kind of tactile, instrumental, and much more kind of technical and analytical way of learning an instrument, it utilizes the relationship to song in the mind of any child. Right. And so you learn music from very early on just through listening back to it.
Okay.
And you're also learning to read music, and you're learning those kind of more theoretical skills. But
so you're not physically picking up a violin at this stage?
You are picking up a violin, but you learn every song that you learn from the... I started when I was 4 years old. Every song that you learn, you're also listening to tapes of that song. You're immersing yourself more in the sound of it, not just in the kind of reading of the notes. And you're not restricted to only learning a piece that you can read off a page. That's the best way of describing it. So that was my relationship with the violin. I had a wonderful teacher. She was one of these teachers that galvanized more young people than you would expect to want to play the violin and want to play string instruments and want to be in string ensembles. So she had everybody kind of enthused and excited, extremely energetic teacher. And she actually suggested that I audition for the Ehudi Menuhin School when I was 9 years old.
Right.
And that school is a specialist music school. So there was only out of 55
students. Is that the one you moved to Surrey?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So I moved there when I was 10. It's a boarding school, very intense, but also very very nurturing if what you mm-hmm. want to do and your priority is to play mm-hmm. your instrument. It's an environment that if that is your priority, even at the age of 10, then that's the place you would like to be.
So moving away from home at a very young age, parents around you or nearby or...?
My parents stayed in Scotland, okay. and I mean, that was pretty horrific for mm-hmm. me. I mean, I was very, very close to my parents, particularly my mum. To move away was quite horrible, actually, but... Mm-hmm. Somehow, even at that age, I had a very decisive idea of what was important to me, and that importance rested around the violin. And mm-hmm. I kind of look back at it now, and I meet a lot of 10-year-olds these days, mm-hmm. and I think that was kind of unusual, I guess, to be like so
how
sure
do you think,
about the
that
violin
board
that
and life
age.
Experience has shaped the person that you are today in terms of resilience, independence.
I basically think you're born with a set of tendencies, mm-hmm. and that your experiences, particularly before the age of 15, let's say, mm-hmm. The millions of experiences you walk through on a daily basis, they mould how you deal with your set of what you were born with.
Yeah.
And I think your decisions inform the person you are. The person you are informs the decisions you make. So I think it's a very kind of messy mix of all of those things. And I've always thought that there are some people in the world that have just slightly more dominant personalities, where regardless of their circumstance, they have an ideal and they have an idea for what they want to chase, and they will do that. Mm-hmm. I would put my dad in that category. Mm-hmm. He achieved and kind of went for what he wanted against all odds. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in that environment. I had unbelievable support from mm-hmm. my parents, and in many ways a kind of idealistic environment. But that's not to say, first of all, our home was not all just roses and peaches. You know, we had a lot of ups and downs mm-hmm. in our kind of family life. But equally, I didn't come from a musical household. Mm-hmm. So for me going to Menuhin School, I was in a great minority, actually. Mm-hmm. Most students that were there either had musical parents or parents that were at least very, I don't want to say my parents weren't cultured, they were in their own way, but they were aware mm-hmm. of music, of art, of that kind mm-hmm. of...
At what point did the drive of music, at what point do you recall back to your kind of teenage life, perhaps, when you started to notice this is something you really wanted?
There was no moment like that for me at all, because, I mean, like I said, when I was 9, 10, I was already... I wasn't forced to go to that school. Uh-huh. My mum said, if this is what you're serious about doing, this is what you should do. But there was no pressure from anybody. I mm-hmm. chose to go there mm-hmm. and in an alien environment mm-hmm. and obviously loved and prioritised playing enough to want to do that. And that was just how my life continued. You know, the decisions, incremental decisions and very large decisions to mm-hmm. constantly want to pursue a life of playing the violin. So if that is so clear to you, you're not looking for a moment to tell you this is what I want to do with my life. I never, ever, ever questioned it.
So BBC Young Musician of the Year, 16?
Yeah.
So I guess kind of performance, you've performed in lots of different settings, in front of royalty, in front of television, thousands of people. When was, I kind of just want to unpick a little bit more your kind of school age time. When was a big performance that might have made you a little nervous?
I had not an unusual relationship to nerves or to worry about mm-hmm. performance. We at the Yehuda Menuhin School, you had what were called lunchtime concerts on a Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. And we were all encouraged to go in for them whenever we had a piece that was kind of prepared enough. And that got, and also at Suzuki Method also, she would arrange kind of little class concerts and stuff. So yeah. The idea of playing in front of people was quite normal to me. But I would get really nervous for those lunchtime concerts. Right. I mean, I would say probably around 12, 13. Okay. 13 was when the relationship to nerves really kicked in. So
you were starting to deal with those feelings quite early on.
Exactly. And I think the whole thing of performing publicly was kind of more of the same until I got to the age of about 16 or 17,
yeah.
When this kind of, you know, I got a recording contract and there was all of this noise and chat, interviews, pressured kind of circumstances, that kind of sudden expanding of... of a, what's not a personality, but like a profile, let's say.
Yeah.
And that's when I think I started becoming far more conscious or self-conscious about who I was, what I was going to do on stage, how to deal mentally with that kind of pressure of expectation. And also, I had many experiences over those years from the age of about 17 where I went on stage and played so much less well than I should have done or I thought
so,
I could have done.
You know, the dialogue of mental health today, I guess you were trying to manage your own perceptions of yourself, other people's perceptions of you very early on. How, what have been your lessons learned throughout the years or top tips for people listening in?
Yeah, I mean, the music world is definitely like a bit of a hothouse for being able to view the kind of pressures that kids can be under. And what's so ironic to me is that we constantly talk about music as a music education and your experience of music as being something that's freeing, that's creative, that is a place to express yourself and to be more confident and to learn confidence. But the flip side of that is when too much pressure and expectation is put on perfection and on somebody being a competent, proficient musician or instrumentalist, it can also have the adverse effect. So I've looked into that a lot and I speak to a lot of college students and a lot of young kids that are just so nervous about playing their instrument. And I do think as much as we want to keep the level of playing as high as possible, that has to go hand in hand. It's like a home that balances discipline with intense love and appreciation for their kids. You need both for
how do you
for
manage,
the result to be positive.
How do you tweak your performance now at such a high level where you've got pressure, television, you might be performing in front of really, you know, your peers at world-class level. And I'm not saying you do fluff your kind of notes.
Of course I do.
I'm sure you do. But so how, you know, when, how do you spot that? How do you avoid that? I'm sure it's practice. But what are the kind of... describe to me some of those moments that where that's happened, particularly on stage.
Oh, it's happened. It happens every concert that something happens that I don't intend. An exercise in overview, focused on the bigger picture.
Right.
Not falling down at small hurdles. Mind over matter. All of these things. A performance is. It's like an intense workshop in how to actually put those ideas into practice. That's not to say that I'm not capable of becoming consumed and like delving into a world of like retrospective thoughts.
Yeah. Do you draw in from experts outside of music? So psychologists or stage perform? I don't know how to present yourself.
A little bit, but not too much because... you live through your experiences, and as much as I have looked into the, like you said, you know, experts in those fields, I think your experience with playing is so specific that it boils down to similar challenges. You know, I at this point, having done thousands and thousands of performances, I know how it feels when a mistake happens, and I know the challenges I'm going to face with having to rise up from that and stay positive. But I do think generally that the world of music making is more sport-like than we give it credit for being. And I think we could learn a lot from other disciplines where psychology and the general kind of training team are far more in the forefront.
In the world, so in the world of teaching, teachers that use social media are starting to access research and cognitive science and psychologists. Yeah. And I want to just unpick techniques for improving performance, maybe from that kind of cognitive science or musician perspective. You know, I grew up in the Salvation Army. I learned the trumpet and the bass and how to sight read. I haven't played for 20 years, but occasionally I'd stand on the stage and do a little solo on a trumpet or a tuba. And my whole family are musical, but I wouldn't call myself very good at all. But what would be... I guess if we just bring it down to perhaps maybe teacher level, school level, what are the kind of techniques or disciplines you would promote in terms of, you know, I've never heard of the Suzuki method, for example, but back to the classroom, what kind of work do you do with schools and what are your top tips for teachers or children that are, you see their love of music evolving?
So I would start off with the physicality and its relationship to your psychology and your emotional state.
Okay.
So often, because because playing is tactile and it's something that is physical and technical,
so
and
do
is
we mean
challenging.
Posture in relationship to the instrument.
Sort of. Okay. What I mean is when I'm talking about physicality. I don't know if you've had this experience, seeing a lot of people play musical instruments, but they can often be quite stiff.
Yeah.
So because their tiny muscles are trying to do something difficult, you're literally the tips of your fingers are trying to be placed in the right right part of the thing. We tend to lock the rest of our bodies, and that has an immediate effect on your brain, and vice versa. If your brain is locked, it has an immediate effect on your body. So people's relationship to music, for me, has to have at its core a freedom of movement, a generosity of movement, and something that actually has a kind of flow to it, rather than being something that is scared, that's stiff, and that's really static. Okay. And I think we're particularly bad at that in the UK. There are other countries that where people naturally have a slightly more fluid relationship to their physicality. So I would say that whether it's learning the violin or it's singing choir or be aware of your physicality and therefore your technicality with your instrument, but don't relegate that to something that is less profound than being expressive or being musical. They're linked. They're exactly the same.
How do you stay in the flow in a high-pressured performance?
I literally break myself out of what my tendency would be, which is to stiffen up. Okay. Absolutely. So I will go above and beyond into an environment where actually, you know, because you're taking risks, because you're engaged in larger movements, you're more likely to do something wrong because you're not being careful. You're being free, but it's like a lesson in trust and in carefreeness in your life anyway. Like if you're willing to actually open yourself up to a vulnerability, yes, you're more vulnerable, you're more susceptible to perhaps something not going your way, but isn't that a far more preferable way
to be? Yeah, absolutely, yeah. You talk about the flow. I've read up on a chap for years now, a Hungarian psychologist called Csikszentmihalyi.
Hungarians know a lot about
this. Yeah, and he talks about the flow, and his cognitive science term is immersion, which I think what you're describing is you get immersed in what you're doing, the performance.
Right.
And I think that's that. Rather than being too tight or loose, it's kind of getting into the rhythm of it.
Right, so talking about immersion, I would actually say that I often say that our highest intelligence, it's not me that says it, our highest intelligence is our intuition and our instinct. And we all know that with an increase and an overload of information, we often are cutting off our relationship to our intelligence and to our instinct.
Right.
And I see so many people doing that with music. If only we could relax enough parts of our brain and of our body, we would actually feel what the music wants to do. I heard a little girl, she was singing to me down the phone the other day. She's a beautiful singer. She's only 11.
Okay.
And she was just learning a new song, which was quite difficult. And I could literally hear her vocal cords tense up when she would get to something that was... was challenging, or that she was unsure about. And what I was trying to say to her is allow a potential wobble or a mistake to happen, but stay free. Keep the muscles actually relaxed, because then you have a natural relationship to how melody should go and how you should phrase something or be musical with something. Mm-hmm. And if you are able to stay free enough, you will... sense and your kind of your body and your mind will sense where that thing should
be. It's very interesting. It's a good top tip. And I guess the kind of the links to sports, maybe aspects of business or teaching, you know, with 30 kids around you, it's very hard as a teacher physically. But what your work with schools and kids, what kind of things are you doing with schools across the country or perhaps the world?
Well, what I've focused on mostly is the form of workshops. So I have visited many schools over the years, of course, but what we've tried to do is create an environment where kids from all different environments, all different schools, and many different levels of relationship to their instrument can come into a workshop environment, all play together, learn from each other. We give them repertoire that is appropriate to their age and stage. And sometimes we do a kind of multi-level repertoire. So you have a very basic part, which is just kind of open strings and more basic rhythms, all the way up to a much more advanced part. But the kids just playing the basic repertoire feel like they're a part of of this much more... much more complex sound and much more complex structure. Within those workshops, we try to address every single potential lesson that can be gained from an experience with music.
Okay.
So that is looking at, of course, the whole connection to...
Is that with music teachers or just the general...
So those workshops, what we've tended to do over the last few years is split them 50-50. An experience for young kids, and that would range from the most kind of beginner level to much more advanced level. And the other 50% is for teachers, so more of a kind of CBD workshop where we are trying to reveal to them all the best work in music that's going on around the country. Because my belief is that there are people doing incredible things in classrooms and individual lessons within charities. Some are set up in any given community where they have kind of gone into three or four schools in that community, and the whole environment is one that embraces music. Showcase to as many other teachers as possible what is going on.
What are the common issues that you hear from teachers about teaching music?
Under-resourced, under-inspired, under-supported. An environment within their school that doesn't understand how, if only they embraced the musical component to education, they would see the kind of, first of all, the enjoyment that the children would get from that experience in isolation. But they would also understand how generally within their school environment it would be an uplifting experience.
There's 8 million kids in our state schools, and music's statutory until about the age of 14. And then, are you familiar with the EBAC curriculum?
Yes.
What are your views on the current policies or curriculum where it's a choice at that age?
I mean, I don't always think that examinations are the beyond end all with regards to the placement of any given experience in education. Mm-hmm. So I don't think for music to have a place in the teenage years of education, it necessarily has to be examined. That said, it was very clear when music was taken off that obligation, the numbers of people taking GCSE music and taking those exams decreased rapidly. But my question is, first of all,
what have we been doing wrong in the experience of music in schools that has relegated it to something that's so unimportant? Or, and I don't purely put that into the hands of an imaginary power that be that that has suddenly enforced on us this idea that music isn't important. I think it is the responsibility of every single music teacher.
I agree. We have this dichotomy of, you know, politicians don't have it on the curriculum. You've got maybe middle class, upper class parents that can afford the tuition after school hours, so your lower income families can't choose. You've got kids growing up with X Factor so they can get a quick fix to celebrity status. I think it's very complex. Any possible suggestions for the kind of system of how to combat perceptions, curriculum?
I mean, I would support music going back onto the EBAC system. I would absolutely support that. I would, but realistically, I think if we can gain more solidity within the music community and within the music education community and showcase better how incredible these experiences can be, showcase in a far more cohesive, fierce manner what children and their families and their parents experience through a long-term connection with music and experience with music. I think we have to do a better job of showing its power and
absolutely
its beauty.
You know, the mental health aspect, the cognitive abilities, the spatial and losing kind
awareness.
Of my musical physicality and all those types of things. I've got one more question. I'm going to give you loads of quick fire questions after this one. Tell me more about the Benedetti Foundation. I know it's in its emerging.
Yes. So Benedetti Foundation has its first official workshops in January next year. Those workshops will cater to all levels of string playing. We're starting off with strings because that is where we're safest and have most experience. But there will also be a massive emphasis on general musicianship, which will be focused on those fundamental building blocks of music that I think are so beautiful and so profound and so impactful. We'll also be focusing all of our experiences as being targeted to teachers and available for teachers. So we have put so much work already into making, you know, it's from Friday to Sunday.
And this is for state and international, independent, anyone that wants it?
Absolutely. Okay. It's extremely affordable. It's like £5, £10 for you to come for a weekend of activities. Everything is provided for you to have an experience that hopefully isn't purely inspiring for those that are, you know, trying to create the next virtuoso violinist. It's not about that. This is something that really is appropriate for all and is we're trying to target every concept in terms of teaching music and for also primary school teachers to have the confidence to be able to embed music into
I see thousands of primary teachers, you know, they're singing, they're playing the piano, hitting the drum, or they've never touched the piano before and they've got to do an assembly. And
yeah, exactly. I'm sure you do.
Yeah, incredible.
So it's to kind of bolster that experience.
Right.
And
I'm very excited. I think
them.
It's very honourable and I look forward to seeing how that pans out. And,
Thank you.
Good luck extending the disciplines. Okay, Nikki, so we're going to do some quick fire. I want you to not pause. I want an instant answer.
I'm terrible at this.
What
just
project
you know.
Are you working on at the moment? I know you'll have lots, but give me a key one.
Learning 6 violin concertos at one time. Do you want to know them?
Crikey, yeah, go on.
Sibelius, Tchaikovsky, Bruch, Shostakovich, Elgar and Bartok.
Okay, and with that, how many hours are you practicing per day or per week on average?
It depends on what my arms can bear, but it could be up to 6 or 7.
Okay. I'm getting distracted now. And the fingers and the strings. I mean, I know
that's
when I try to play the guitar, it was awful. When I
No, the fingers don't actually press that hard on a violin.
Right.
So if you're getting massive big crevices in
Too
your fingers,
hard.
That shouldn't
okay.
be
right. I'm distracted. What book are you reading or podcast?
I'm actually rereading Anna Karenina.
Okay. Any books on music? Specifically or non-fiction?
No, I'm reading more just like many different articles and okay. I mean, we're so consumed with stuff for the foundation at the moment. I'm always reading something, but I'm more dipping in and out of lots of different books.
If you weren't a classical violinist, what would be your dream job?
I think some kind of activist or perhaps a teacher.
Okay, nice. Who would you recommend I interviewed next and why?
Oh, Wynton Marsalis.
Okay.
Because he's managed to combine playing, teaching, the sharing of music, and also you should interview him because he'll tell you about why the building blocks of jazz are so related to social structures.
Okay, fascinating. Do you have a favourite catchphrase or mum and dad give you a bit of advice that's gone through the last 30 years of your life? Anything that sticks?
My favourite catchphrase is probably, not that I ever really use it, but put everything into what you do, make sure you share what you do.
Okay. Where can listeners find out more about you? Blogs, books, podcasts, websites?
Websites. Okay. Hopefully whatever's out there is actually on my website. I don't keep good enough tabs on it, but yeah, my website.
Okay. Thank you, Nikki. It's been an absolute honour to meet you.
Thank you.
Good luck with the foundation. I look forward to kind of supporting you online and physically if I can. And good luck with an already incredible career, and I'm sure you'll go on to inspire millions of kids around the world.
Thank you. Nice to meet you. Thank you.
You are listening to Teacher Toolkit. You can find out more about 100 Years, 100 Women on our website, teachertoolkit.co.uk, or follow us on social media using the hashtag TTKit100Women.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.